happy to see you all here today on this glorious day. So I'm Sean Redding. I'm in the Department of History here, and it's my very great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this afternoon. Though she holds degrees from universities here in Massachusetts, today's speaker, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, comes to us from Nigeria, a country where she recently served as finance minister and also as foreign minister. She served with courage, ingenuity, and great success, engineering a deal to slash Nigeria's debt by more than half, cracking down on corruption, and introducing reforms to numerous sectors of the economy. Since 2007, Dr. Okonjo-Iweala has been a managing director of the World Bank, overseeing its poverty reduction efforts in Africa, South Asia, Europe, and Central Asia. She is a former distinguished visiting fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institution, founder of NOI Global Consulting, and co-founder of the Makeda Fund to invest in the entrepreneurial efforts of the real engines of African economies everywhere, African women. She is the recipient of numerous awards and honors, including a spot on the Forbes list of the 100 most powerful women in the world in 2006, and Euromoney Global Finance Minister of the Year in 2005. She's also the founder of the Center for Research on the Economies of Africa, a think tank based in Nigeria. Please welcome this leader in improving economic conditions around the world, Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala.
Well, thank you, Sean. Good afternoon to everybody. It's a glorious day outside, so you must really be keen to hear me. Don't miss out on that wonderful sunshine out there. What a beautiful campus. It's very difficult to think about the economic crisis and what is happening when you stroll around and see the peace and calm and beauty out there. But that's what I'm going to talk about this afternoon. And since it's not very often, I presume that people hear about the impact of the crisis on developing countries, particularly on Africa, I'm going to spend much of my time talking about that. But I'd perhaps like to set the context a little bit by talking a bit more generally about the crisis and then try to focus. If I go on for too long, stop me, because I do want to leave some time for a little bit of interaction, because I sense a lot of energy in the room. Before I start, I'd like to take a poll of the audience. How many of you here think that this crisis is having any kind of impact on developing countries, particularly African countries? Oh, everybody. Oh, this is fantastic. Then I don't have to labor too hard to make my case. But let me say that that the phrase that we're in the throes of the most serious financial crisis since the Great Depression is a phrase or an expression that has become part of the standard vocabulary by now. And it talks about not just a financial crisis across the globe, but an economic crisis. And in certain parts of the world, a humanitarian crisis. As people are laid off and firms have been reducing output and closing off, not just here in the U.S., but worldwide. World economic growth shrank to 1.7% in 2008 from 3.7% in 2007. And for the first time since World War II, global real GDP, gross domestic product, is expected to decline in 2009 by a significant 1.7%. The closest that we came to this before was in 1982, when global growth was 0.3% following the second oil shock. We also face a 6% drop in the volume of world trade in goods and services, the largest decline in 80 years. A press report in late February noted that the number of idle ships worldwide, which is a good indicator of how trade is doing, has reached a new record, accounting for unused capacity equal to 8.8% of the world's cargo space. Lloyd's List in Britain notes that if demand grew at an average of 15% over the next 3 years, a tall order, then equilibrium would just about be restored by early 2013. In addition, the current crisis is shaping up globally as the most complex ever. We might have thought it would be easy to deal with, dust off the playbook from the Great Depression, avoiding the mistakes of monetary tightening and fiscal austerity, avoid the mistakes of Japan, go quickly for a large fiscal stimulus, and learn from the efforts of Sweden in how to resolve the problems of the financial sector. In the U.S. itself, decisive steps have been taken to ease the credit crunch and provide a fiscal stimulus to aggregate demand. Two amazing statistics illustrate the size of the fiscal and monetary policy response in this country. The size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet has gone from about $870 billion before Lehman's collapse in mid-September 2008 to $2.2 trillion in mid-May, an increase of 150%. And the U.S. fiscal deficit as a result of the stimulus spending and falling revenues is expected to go from 3.2% of GDP in 2008 to a very large whopping 12.9% in 2009. So whilst there's still a long way to go in terms of returning to where we were before Lehman's collapse last September, financial indicators have stabilized in the U.S., both with respect to the stock market and the interbank market, and emerging market equities have staged a remarkable rally over the past few months. But the financial crisis has seeped into the real economy, and the results so far are not pretty. Japan has now registered two double-digit quarterly declines in GDP at a 14.4% annual pace in the last quarter of 2008, and Eurozone GDP fell by close to 10%, a 10% annual pace in the first quarter of 2009, led by a significant collapse in Germany, the world's biggest exporter of goods. And growth in the developing countries, which concerns me the most, has been set back by at least 2 percentage points in 2009 relative to 2008, preventing some 53 million people from escaping poverty, a number that we've calculated in the World Bank. So looking forward, what are we in for? Can we avoid an L-shaped recession in the rich countries? And if not a sharp, quick, V-shaped recovery, can we pin our hopes on a slower U-shaped recovery? The answer to this question is important, not only in and of itself, but also because of the impact it will have on the prospects for poorer developing countries via the various links like exports, foreign direct investment, remittances, and the like. The global crisis has put paid to the notion that some parts of the world can be, quote-unquote, decoupled. The idea of decoupling or being able to develop without much linkages to the other seems to have gone by the bush. In coming up with the answer to the question I posed on the type of recovery, it's important to keep in mind that we are dealing with a highly complex, virtually unprecedented interactions among financial markets, trade, and the real sector. And here are some points to ponder. First, the U.S. has been in recession since December 2007. That's 17 months and counting. Europe and Japan have both endured negative quarterly growth rates over the past four quarters, with rising intensity. Considering that the last sharp V-shaped recession in the U.S. in 2001 lasted about 8 months, I think it's safe to say that the tussle looking forward is between an L-shaped stagnation and hopefully a U-shaped recovery. Second, extensive research at the IMF on past recessions reported in April 2009 edition of the World Economic Outlook suggests that we are in for a long and deep recession because the current crisis started in the financial sector and is synchronized across countries. This suggests that the earliest we can expect positive world growth is probably in late 2009, mainly as a result of the faster rebound in emerging and low-income countries. I know it's risky to even try to talk about this because sometimes the shape of what is happening in our economies is difficult to talk about. But I think we can look towards some return to some positive signs by late 2009 and early 2010. Third, what happens eventually depends critically upon the strength of fiscal and monetary policies in the rich countries, as well as in those developing countries that can afford fiscal stimulus like China and India. Restoring the financial system to health is central to all this. As Chairman Bernanke observed in a speech a few months ago, the fiscal stimulus is not going to have a lasting impact unless banks start lending again and capital markets resume normal function. To sum up, in terms of the U.S. and global impact, we can say with some confidence that the decisive actions taken by policymakers in the rich countries have dispelled panic in the financial markets and eliminated probably the chances of another Great Depression. But while the financial markets may be putting out quote-unquote tender green shoots, and I know that this is debatable, we still need to contend with the quote-unquote Great Recession, to borrow a term coined by the IMF, in a highly interdependent and complex world. Because whilst the financial markets may be stabilizing, the real economy is still going through some very complex changes. As I said earlier, the speed and extent of the recovery in the rich countries has material consequences for what happens in the poorer developing world. So now let me make the journey to that part of the world, to a continent that is not as much talked about in the context of this crisis, and that's to Africa. Let me start with a little bit of background. Until 2008, Africa's GDP growth had been averaging 5% a year for a decade, with a rising trend. In fact, forecast 5.9% in 2006, with forecast for 6% and better in 2008 and 2009. Not many people know that how well the continent was performing prior to this crisis. And over this high growth period, poverty was declining at a faster rate than in South Asia, still large numbers of absolute poor, but the trend was on the way down. Health and education indicators were improving, albeit from a low base, and there were signs that certain health issues like the HIV/AIDS epidemic and the prevalence rate had begun to decline all over the continent. In achieving these outcomes, policy reforms, improving governance, greater political and social stability, albeit with conflicts flaring in certain fragile and post-conflict countries like Zimbabwe, the Democratic Republic of Congo, etc. The point is that the continent had begun to stabilize. Many countries had put in place measures that mitigated volatility and had begun to provide the kind of environment on which the continent could really begin to make progress. After this decade spent addressing domestic weaknesses in policies and institutions with some success, Africa was then hit by three major external shocks in 2008. The first, a 50% increase in food prices, in real terms, the food crisis. A surge in world oil prices, as everyone saw, with prices that reached $140 a barrel, which was particularly difficult for many of the oil importing countries. And at the same time, this financial crisis. So three major crises all in a short period of time. Small oil importers such as Eritrea, Togo, and Senegal suffered terms of trade shocks that were quite significant, up to 5 to 10% of GDP. And the global recession has led to the African 2009 growth forecast being downgraded to 1.7% compared to the better than 6% figure, which I mentioned a short while ago. Actual growth in 2008 is estimated at almost 5%. So we are looking at a projected 3 percentage point fall in growth this year. So that's a very large kind of shock to the continent. So how has Africa been weathering this storm? Let me talk first about the food fuel and crisis. I would also add a fertilizer crisis to that. I always talk about the four Fs: food, fuel, fertilizer, and financial. And I wonder why they all start with F. We need to look at that. I'll talk about the food and fuel and fertilizer crisis first, and then I'll come back to the financial and economic crisis. Oh, and by the way, before I continue, I was talking with a friend the other day who said that if we had had Lehman sisters instead of Lehman brothers, we might have been in better shape. So go figure. The response of the continent to the food, fuel, and fertilizer crisis has been swift and decisive, with help from the international donor community. Ghana and Niger put additional money into existing social assistance programs. Guinea did the same with its community development projects, and Ethiopia increased wages through a major public works program. Many governments, such as Sierra Leone and Ghana, again lowered taxes on imported food, with donor assistance making up the lost tariff revenues. Some governments introduced export restrictions and price controls, but these proved to be ineffective, and they were soon abandoned. Quick disbursing infusions of cash by development partners did more than help poor people buy food. They provided fiscal and therefore political space for governments to avoid rash and counterproductive policies that could undermine the reforms that they had done in the past. I'm proud to say that the World Bank acted swiftly in this regard under a program which I was asked to personally try and put together to respond to the problems in Africa and other developing countries. We put together a $1.2 billion Global Food Crisis Response Fund within the bank, and we accelerated the implementation, design and implementation of programs, either quick budget support, but more importantly, helping countries to put in place programs that could help them grow food and put in place sustainable policies for the future. The issue that many countries were interested in was not food aid. That's not what African countries are looking for. They want policies and assistance that can help them respond to their issues in a sustainable manner. So we focused a lot on trying to get the planting season going, on providing fertilizer and seeds at the right time, and making sure that those resources, in addition to marketing, was available. I'm proud to say that unprecedented in the past, we disbursed almost $800 million of that within 8 months, getting resources down to where it mattered. In Liberia, for instance, down to the women and the farmers in the country, in Guinea-Bissau, helping them weather the problem in Mali, in Burkina Faso. And we did this working with the country's own programs that they crafted under the aegis of the AU plans for country plans for agriculture. So in addition to protecting the poorest, many African governments saw the increase in food prices, and especially the new linkage to higher oil prices via biofuels, as an opportunity to invest in agricultural productivity, as I've said. The African Union launched this continent-wide program to boost productivity through better infrastructure, especially water resources technology, and targeted smart subsidies of fertilizer and other inputs to African farmers. And this is what most of the $1.2 billion disbursed by the bank went to support. Similarly, the response to the 2008 oil price increase was impressive. For the 37 oil-importing countries of the continent, this meant a big terms of trade deterioration, amounting to 6 to 10% of their GDP. For countries like Togo, Senegal, Cape Verde, Eritrea, and Seychelles, again, most countries avoided politically expedient but unaffordable policies through imposing price controls. And I think this was really laudable in light of the fact that there was a great deal of political tension and demonstrations on the streets due to the food and fuel crisis in many of these countries. Many of them passed through some higher oil prices to consumers while trying to cushion the impact on the poorest among the population. And whilst inflation rose in some countries like Ethiopia, the fact that the fiscal deficit did not increase significantly has made it easier to bring inflation back down, as it's beginning to do now in Ethiopia. On the other side of the trade equation, the three largest oil exporters, Angola, Gabon, and Nigeria, all of them used a reference price of oil of about $57 a barrel in their budgetary execution and thus saved a substantial chunk of the windfall. I actually want to spend a moment on this. For the oil importing countries, particularly for my country, Nigeria, things changed because of changing the way that volatility was managed in the economy. And several countries who did the type of policies that Nigeria did, were able to weather this crisis much better than they would have in the past. In the past, oil exporting countries used to spend all they earned. Whenever they earned got higher prices from oil, it was all spent. And when oil prices would fall, their spending would crash back down. And so the economy experienced tremendous volatility. And of course, that kind of expenditure pattern also fuels corruption. Because when there's a lot of money sloshing around in the economy, contracts tend to be given out that are not very productive. What happened was, during the time that I was in government, with the economic team that we had, we put in place a rule, which we call an oil price-based fiscal rule, in which we would budget at a price of oil lower than the going market price. And we were able to save the difference over the 3 years I was there. When I started in government, we had $7 billion in reserves. And in fact, we were losing reserves, which said we had meant we had a very loose fiscal policy. Over those 3 years, we went from $7 billion to $38 billion that was saved, that we had in reserves, with the difference that I talked about in the oil price. And that has helped Nigeria weather this crisis much better because it was able to undertake a fiscal stimulus using part of that money. And Angola was also able to do part of the same, and Gabon. So some lessons have been learned from the past that have helped the oil exporting countries weather the crisis. And as I said, the oil importing countries manage their economies very responsibly during this time. So this then brings me to talk about how has the impact of the global financial crisis itself been transmitted to the African economies. Initially, many people thought that Africa would escape the impact of this crisis because its banking, its financial sector is not as well linked to the global financial economy as is the case in some of the emerging market countries in Eastern Europe and even in Latin America. But three countries were linked, South Africa, Kenya, and Nigeria, through their financial systems, suffered some impact, whilst the rest of the continent escaped the impact through the financial sector. And we saw portfolio flows leave those three countries. We saw their stock markets fall by an average 40%, and we saw the exchange rates affected and depreciating by up to 25% and more in some cases. But the rest of the continent has really been affected through the real sectors of the economy. And there have been several channels of this. In the early phases, the countries have been affected through the drying up of investment, foreign direct investment. In many countries, investments that were going to be made were put on hold and were not made. For example, a $500 million investment that was to have been made in Guinea's bauxite industry was held up. In Liberia, was with President Johnson Sirleaf, who had been expecting a $1.5 billion investment in the iron ore industry from ArcelorMittal. That was put on hold. Another $500 million investment in the copper industry in Zambia equally dried up. So jobs that would have been created through these channels were not done. The countries were also mostly impacted through the impact on commodity prices. As we've seen, the prices of many commodities decline. Copper prices fell by 50%, and so we saw Zambia losing about 10,000 jobs in the copper industry. In the DRC, many people do not know that up to 48 mines were closed in the mining belt, with 200,000 jobs lost. In Cameroon, about 1,500 jobs in the wood industry have been lost, the third largest export earner, and they have no orders in their books coming up for the future. And even in agriculture, cotton exports already being impacted by the policies of the developed countries in terms of the subsidies to the cotton sector has suffered even more. And countries like Burkina Faso, Tanzania, and so on have cotton produced by the farmers, which they cannot export. And one could go on and on, but this has been the channel by which the continent has been really much impacted. Another channel is through remittances. Remittances are important in many African economies, both in East and West Africa. In East Africa and in Southern Africa. Many of the remittances come from South Africa, which itself has been reeling from the impact of the crisis. And so we've seen countries like Lesotho, where remittances make up 29% of its GDP, seeing a very significant fall off and impact. But over 77% of African remittances come from the U.S. and Western Europe. And we've seen that come down significantly. Kenya saw a fall off in remittances one quarter to the next by about 40%, for instance. So this has been a very, very important channel. Another channel is tourism revenues, which are declining in many countries, with gloomy prospects in countries from Kenya, Tanzania, and Seychelles, as we see bookings in hotels drop off by up to 25% in some of the countries alone. I already mentioned the impact through the closure of many mines and so on labor. This has been very important. And even the aid flows have not been immune. While donors have continuously pledged that they will maintain their aid flows, well, we know that they're already $20 billion short of the commitments they made on aid to Africa in Glen Eagles. And so there's some uncertainty. And one of the things we're doing at the World Bank is trying to make sure that countries keep their commitments that they've made to several of the African countries who have significant aid dependence in their budgets. Now, in the World Bank, I mentioned what we did to try and help countries weather the food crisis. And we've continued to work with them in terms of the way that they deal with the financial crisis. If the countries in the West are able to arrange large stimulus packages for themselves, many of the developing countries, particularly the African countries, don't have the fiscal space to be able to have this kind of stimulus. So the international financial institutions are the institutions that have sought to help them, whether it's the World Bank or the African Development Bank or the IMF, to try and have the resources to get through the crisis. At the World Bank, we set up a vulnerability financing facility where we have up to about $2 billion that we are trying to fast track to these countries to enable them cope with the crisis. The private sector arm of the World Bank, the International Finance Corporation, has also set up various types of funds to try and deal with the private sector aspect of this. A $500 million microfinance fund to help inject resources into very small enterprises. A banking recapitalization fund, and very importantly, an infrastructure crisis facility. Because during the stimulus, supporting projects, particularly if you can do rural infrastructure projects and other kinds of related projects, is one way to help keep employment going and keep these countries able to respond. We are not sure that we've seen the workings out of the impact of the crisis on African countries yet. We think this is still working through the real sectors. And we've not seen the bottom there yet. But the interesting thing is that we now think that the crisis will work from the real sectors back into the financial sector and impact the way that the financial sector and the banking sector responds. So this is what we're watching and trying to gear ourselves up with instruments that can help these countries deal with that as the crisis evolves. It is critically important that there's a recovery in the developed countries, because without that, it will become very difficult for the developing countries to also recover because of the need, the tie-in with the global system, the demand for exports and for other goods and services that the developed country makes from the developing countries. Similarly, it is in the interest of the developed countries to ensure that the developing countries, including African countries, do well to recover from this crisis, because they are part of aggregate global demand. And so the idea that you would not, that it is not in the interest of the developed countries to help African countries or other developing countries recover is not true. It's very much in the global interest to try to do that. This is quite apart from the humanitarian angle, where this crisis is translating into the real lives of people in African countries. As I mentioned earlier, we feel we've calculated that 53 million more people are falling into poverty as a result of this crisis. And in many African countries, this translates into people not having three meals a day, people not being able to send their children to school, people not being able to have adequate health care in a situation that is already fragile. So this is real, and that is why the need to pay attention and to see what can be done to assist African countries and developing countries to bounce out of the crisis is just as important. It's a humanitarian thing, but beyond that, it's also an economic imperative because they form part of the world economy. Let me now, having talked about this, just step back as I try to conclude and think past the crisis and say, how do we think the world economy should be shaping up going forward? As Larry Summers noted during a speech recently at the Brookings Institution, there's one lesson of history that we all know to hold and to be true with financial crises, and that is that they will end. So let me, as a result of this, so it's good to say that, that there's light at the end of the tunnel. How they end is really the critical issue. But this crisis will end. Let me put four issues on the table for us to think about as we think through what happens after the crisis. The first is that global imbalances need to be put right, which essentially means that the U.S. consumer can no longer serve as the demander of last resort in the global economy. Not only should we expect to see reduced leverage in the U.S. as a result of the financial sector reform, solving the global imbalance problem means a real depreciation of the dollar, higher savings in the U.S., and increased resort to domestic demand in China. Exactly how this new equilibrium will be reached and play out is not clear, but it is a crucial question. Second, what will happen to the use of natural resources and their prices once global growth resumes? Can China and India, growing at the fast pace rates they recorded before the crisis hit, can they continue to do that? And what are the implications for the fight against climate change if they do that? Third, how is the rebalancing between the respective roles of the government and the market going to be handled? We've witnessed the return of Keynesian economics and massive interventions by governments of the rich countries in the financial and real sectors. Does this invalidate the development and growth paradigm we have espoused in the past based on market discipline, fiscal sustainability, and outward orientation? This is a question that everyone is asking now, and one that we need to think through. But it's too provocative a question to leave unanswered. So let me say in a nutshell that I believe that the basic development and growth paradigm that we are pursuing is not invalidated by the crisis. But the crisis certainly prompts for a rethinking of the financial sector and not just in this country but globally, in terms of financial sector regulation and surveillance, and of the shape of the global economy, which leads back to the questions I asked in the beginning about how we see the recovery in the U.S. and whether the U.S. can continue consuming and not saving, and whether China can continue depending on exports largely to make its economy grow. Fourth, which follows from the third, can developing countries rely on external finance, or should they focus more on raising national savings and institute some form of capital controls? As befits a college like Amherst, which has produced one president, two Nobel Prize winners in economics, including Joe Stiglitz, a good friend of mine, and a host of distinguished mathematicians, scientists, writers, public servants, and others, I shall leave these questions to be pondered and answered by you. And since we are going to have an interactive session, I expect to hear the answers back, so you don't have too much time for pondering. Let me just say one that there's one encouraging sign so far, if anything, arising out of this crisis. and that is on the African continent. African countries have learned that they and only they can solve their problems. They've learned that they need to take hold of their economies, and that if they don't reform, they will not be able to make progress. They've learned to stick to the difficult things to do in spite of the strong political imperatives in many countries that might make them want to do otherwise. This is a very important lesson, that in time of crisis, you stick to the fundamentals, that you continue to reform, that you stick to doing the right thing, and that you then use the assistance from others to help strengthen the way that you respond. African countries have learned out of this crisis that they have to depend primarily on themselves and not on others coming in. But that does not mean that the international community should not seek to help. In fact, this is the time that developed countries, international financial institutions need to come behind African countries as they try to take their destinies into their own hands and need to help them think beyond the crisis into how they can maintain the type of sustainable responses and sustainable economic policies that will actually tackle the fundamental poverty in these countries and begin to raise the bulk of their population onto higher living standards. A number of these lessons will stand the continent in good stead in trying to move forward in finding its place in the global economy. So out of every crisis, there are opportunities. And what we have seen is that many of the countries on the continent have learned to seize the opportunity that there is. Let us see how we can get behind whilst answering the questions of what the crisis means to try and support these countries to move forward in a more difficult and complex global environment. Thank you very much.